The mountain was further off than it had seemed in the red light of the dawn. As they marched towards it, it seemed to recede rather than draw closer. As the light changed, so the mountain changed its mood. It became remote and austere, and the stone cliffs glittered in the sunlight like a crocodile's scales. Owa sang as he trotted at the head of the file. "See, spirits of the sand, we come to your secret place. With clean hands unstained by blood, see, spirit of Ilant and Mantis, we come to visit you with joyous hearts and songs for your amusement." The mountain changed again, began to quiver and tremble in the rising heat. It was no longer massive stone, but rippled like water and wavered like smoke. It broke free of the earth and floated in the air on a shimmering silver mirage. "O bird mountain that flies in the sky, we bring you praises. O elephant mountain, greater than any beast of earth or sky, we hail you." Owa sang, and as the sun swung through its zenith and the air cooled, so the mountain of all life settled to earth again and loomed high above them. They reached the scree slopes, loose stone and debris that lay piled against the cliffs, and paused to look up at the high summit. The rocks were painted with lichen growth, sulphur yellow and acid green, and the little hyrax rock rabbits had stained the cliffs with seepage from their middens like tears from an elephant's eyes. On a ledge 300 feet above them stood a tiny antelope. It took fright and with a bleat like a child's penny whistle, shot straight up the cliff, leaping from ledge to unseen ledge with all the nimbleness of a chamois until it disappeared over the crest. They scrambled up the steep scree slope until they touched the base of the cliff. The rock was smooth and cool and overhung them, leaning out at a gentle angle like a vast cathedral roof. "Be not angry, ye spirits, that we come into your secret place," Hani whispered, and tears were coursing down her ancient yellow cheeks. "We come in humble peace, kind spirits. We come to learn what our offence has been and how we can make amends." Owa reached out and took his wife's hand, and they stood like two tiny naked children before the smooth rock. "We come to sing for you and to dance," Owa whispered. "We come to make peace, and then with your favour to be reunited with the children of our clan who died of the great fever in a far place." There was such vulnerability in this intimate moment that Sun Tan felt embarrassed to watch them. She drew away from the two old people and wandered alone along the narrow gallery before the cliff. Suddenly she stopped and stared up in wonder at the high rock wall that hung out over her head. "Animals," she whispered. She felt the goose flesh of superstitious fear rise along her forearm, for the walls were decorated with paintings, frescoes of weirdly wrought animals, the childlike simplicity of form giving them a beauty that was dreamlike, and yet a touching resemblance to the beasts that they depicted. She recognized the darkly massive outlines of tusked elephants and horned rhinoceros, the wildebeest and sasabi, with horns like crescent moons marching in closely packed phalanxes across the rock walls.
"And people," Sun Tan whispered, as she picked out the stick-like human shapes that ran in pursuit of the herds of wild game.
"Fairy beings, the sand's view of himself, armed with bows and crowned with wreaths of arrows, the men adorned with proudly erect penises, disproportionately large, and the women with prominent breasts and buttocks, the badges of feminine beauty." The paintings climbed so high up the sheer walls that the artists must have built platforms in the fashion of Michelangelo to work from. The perspectives were naive, one human figure larger than the rhinoceros he was hunting, but this seemed to deepen the enchantment, and Sun Tan lost herself in wonder, sinking down at last to examine and admire a lovely flowing waterfall of overlapping Ilant, ochre and red, with dewlap and humped shoulders so lovingly depicted that their special place in San mythology could not be overlooked. Hani found her there and squatted beside her.
"Who painted these things?" Santan asked her. The spirits of the sun, long, long ago. Were they not painted by men? No, no, men do not have the art. These are spirit drawings. So the artist's skill were lost. Santan was disappointed. She had hoped that the old woman was one of the artists and that she would have an opportunity to watch her work. Long ago, Hani repeated, before the memory of my father or my grandfather. Santan swallowed her disappointment and gave herself up to enjoyment of the marvellous display. There was little left of the daylight, but while it lasted, they picked their way slowly around the base of the cliff, walking with heads thrown back to marvel at the gallery of ancient art. At places the rock had broken away, or the storms and winds of the ages had destroyed the frescoes, but in the protected gullies and beneath the sheltering overhangs the paint seemed so fresh and the colours so vivid that they might have been painted that very day. In the last minutes of daylight they reached a shelter where others had camped before them, for the hearth was thick with wood ash and the cliff was blackened with soot, and there was a pile of dead wood left beside it, ready for use. "Tomorrow we will learn if the spirits are hostile still, or if we will be allowed to proceed," Hani warned Santan. "We will start very early, for we must reach the hidden place before the sun rises, while it is still cool. The guardians become restless and dangerous in the heat." "What is this place?" Santan insisted, but once again the old woman became vague and deliberately absent-minded. She repeated the San word, which had the various meanings of hidden place or safe shelter or vagina, and would say no more. As Hani had warned, they started out long before sunrise the next morning, and the old people were quiet and anxious, and Santan suspected, fearful. The sky was barely lighting with the dawn when abruptly the path turned a sharp corner in the cliff and entered a narrow wedge-shaped valley. The floor was thickly covered with such luxuriant growth that Santan realized there must be good water below the surface. The path was ill-defined, overgrown, and clearly had not been trodden for many months or years. They had to duck under the interlocking branches and step over fallen boughs and new growth. In the cliffs high above them, Santan made out the huge, shaggy nests of vultures and the grossly ugly birds with their bare pink heads crouched on the rim of their nests. "The place of all life." Hani saw her interest in the nesting birds. "Any creature born here is special, blessed by the spirits. Even the birds seem to know this." The high cliffs closed in upon them as the valley narrowed, and at the last path ended against the rock in the angled corner where the valley finally pinched out and the sky was hidden from them. Owa stood before the wall and sang in his hoarse ghost chant. "We wish to enter your most secret place, spirits of all creatures, spirits of our clan. Open the way for us." He spread his arms in entreaty. "May the guardians of this passage let us pass through." Owa lowered his arms and stepped into the black rock of the cliff and disappeared from Santan's sight. She gasped with alarm and started forward. But Hani touched her arm to restrain her. "There is great danger now, Nam child. If the guardians reject us, we will die. Do not run, do not wave your arms. Walk slowly but with purpose, and ask the blessing of the spirits as you pass through." Hani released her arm and stepped into the rock, following her husband. Santan hesitated. For a moment, she almost turned back. But at last curiosity and fear of loneliness spurred her, and she went slowly to the wall where Hani had disappeared. Now she saw the opening in the rock, a narrow vertical crack, just wide enough for her to pass through if she turned her shoulders. She drew a deep breath and slipped through. Beyond the narrow portals, she paused to allow her eyes to become accustomed to the gloom, and she found herself in a long, dark tunnel. It was a natural opening, she saw at once, for the walls had not been worked by tools, and there were side branches and openings high overhead. She heard the rustle of the old people's bare feet on the rocky floor ahead of her, and then another sound, a low, murmurous hum, like the sea surf heard from afar. "Follow Nam Child, stay close." Hani's voice floated back to her, and San Tan went forward slowly, staring into the shadows, trying to find the source of that deep, vibrating murmur. In the gloom above her, she saw strange shapes, plate-like projections from the walls, like the leaves of fungus growing on the trunk of a dead tree, or the multiple wings of roosting butterflies. They drooped so low that she had to duck beneath them, and with a sudden chill, she realized where she was. The cavern was an enormous beehive. These deep wing-like structures were the honeycombs, so massive that each would contain hundreds of gallons of honey. Now she could see the insects swarming over the combs, glittering dully in the poor light, and she remembered the stories that Michael had told her of the African bees. "Bigger and blacker than your bees," he had boasted, "and so vicious that I've seen them sting a bull buffalo to death." Barely allowing herself to breathe, her skin crawling in anticipation of the first burning dart, forcing herself not to run, she followed the diminutive figures ahead of her. The swarming masses of venomous insects were only inches above her, and the humming chorus seemed to rise angrily until it threatened to deafen her. "This way, Nam Child. Do not fear, for the little winged people will smell your fear," Hani called softly, and a bee alighted on San Tan's cheek. She raised her hand instinctively to strike it off her, and then with an effort checked the movement. The bee tickled across her face onto her upper lip, then another settled on her upraised forearm. She peered at it in horror. It was enormous, black as coal, with dark golden rings around its abdomen. The filmy wings were closed like scissor blades, and its multiple eyes twinkled in the poor light. "Please, little bee, please," San Tan whispered, and the insect arched its back, and from its banded abdomen the point of its sting protruded, a dark red needle point. "Please, let me and my baby pass." The bee curved its body, and the sting touched the soft tan skin of her inner elbow. San Tan tensed herself. She knew that the stabbing pain would be followed by the sickly sweet odour of the venom that would madden and infuriate the vast swarm above her. She imagined herself smothered under a living carpet of bees, writhing on the floor of the cavern, dying the most hideous of deaths. "Please," she whispered, "let my baby be born in your secret place, and we will honour you all the days of our lives." The bee retracted the throbbing sting and performed an intricate weaving dance upon her arm, turning and curtsying and reversing, and then, with a quick silver flicker of its wings, darted away. San Tan walked on slowly, and ahead of her she saw a golden nimbus of reflected light. The insect on her face crawled down over her lips, so she could not speak again, but she prayed silently. "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, please, little bee, let me go for my baby's sake." A sharp buzz, and the bee flashed before her eyes, a golden mote as it left her. And though her skin tingled and itched from the memory of its horny feet, she kept her hands at her sides and walked on with a measured step. It seemed forever. Then she reached the tunnel's end and stooped through it into the early dawn light, and her legs began to fold in reaction to her terror. She might have fallen if Owa had not steadied her. "You are safe now. The guardians have allowed us to enter the sacred place." The words roused her, and though she still trembled and her breathing was rough, San Tan looked around her. They had passed through into a hidden basin in the heart of the mountain, a perfectly round amphitheatre in the rock. The walls were sheer, hundreds of feet high, and with a dark satanic sheen to them, as though scorched in the flames of a blast furnace. But above that it was open to the sky. The deep bowl of rock was perhaps a mile across at its widest point. At this time of day the sunlight had not penetrated down to the floor, and the groves of graceful trees that covered it were cool and dewy. They reminded Santan of olives, with fine pale leaves and bunches of reddish-yellow fruit on the widespread boughs. The floor of the valley was gently dished, and as Santan followed Hani down through the trees, the ground beneath them was carpeted with fallen fruit. Hani picked up one of them and offered it to Santan.
Mungungo, very good.
Santan bit into it and exclaimed as a tooth struck painfully on the large kernel in its centre. There was only a thin layer of flesh around it, but it was tart and tasty as a palm date, though not as sweet. From the branches above them, a flight of plump green pigeons exploded into noisy flight, and Santan realized that the valley was alive with birds and small animals, come in the dawn to feast on the fruits of the Mongongo groves.
The place of all life,
she whispered, entranced by the weird beauty, by the stark contrast of bare blasted rock cliffs against this gently wooded bottom land. Owa hurried along the rough path that led down into the centre of the bowl, and as Santan followed she glimpsed a small hillock of black volcanic rock through the trees ahead. Santan saw that the hill was symmetrical and cone-shaped, and set in the exact centre of the amphitheatre, like the boss in the centre of a shield. Like the valley floor, the hill itself was heavily forested. Tall elephant grass and mangongo trees grew profusely among the black volcanic boulders. A troop of black-faced velvet monkeys chattered at them from the trees and ducked their heads threateningly, grimacing with alarm as they approached the hillock. When Santan and Hani caught up with Owa, he was standing facing a dark opening in the side of the hill. It looked like the mouth of a mine shaft, but as she peered into it, Santan realized that the floor of the shaft sloped down at a gentle angle. She pushed past Owa, the better to examine it, but the old man seized her arm.
"Be not hasty, Namchild. We must make preparation in the correct manner."
And he drew her back and led her gently away. A little further on there was an ancient sand campsite amongst the sheltering rocks. The thatched roofs of the shelters had collapsed with age. Owa burned them to the ground, for disused huts harbour snakes and vermin, and the two women rebuilt them with saplings and freshly cut grass.
"I am hungry,"
Santan realized that she had not eaten since the previous evening.
"Come."
Hani led her into the grove, and they filled their satchels with the fallen fruit of the Mongongo trees. Back in the camp, Hani showed Santan how to strip off the outer layer of flesh and then to crack the hard central nut between two flat stones. The kernel looked like a dried almond. They ate a few of those to take the edge of their hunger. They tasted like walnuts.
"We will eat them in many ways," Hani promised. "And each way they taste different, roasted, pounded with leaves, boiled like maize bread. They will be our only food in this place, where all killing is forbidden."
While they prepared the meal, Owa returned to camp with a bundle of freshly dug roots and went aside to prepare them in private, scraping and chopping with his beloved clasp knife. They ate before dark, and Santan found the meal of nuts unexpectedly satisfying. As soon as her stomach was filled, the effect of the day's excitements and exertions caught up with her, and she could barely drag herself to her shelter. She awoke refreshed and with a sense of unexplained excitement. The San were already busy around the campfire, and as soon as she joined them and squatted in the circle, Owa puffed up with nervous anticipation and self-importance, told them,
"We must now prepare to go down into the most secret of places. Do you agree to the purification, old grandmother?"
It was obviously a formal question.
"I agree, old grandfather,"
Hani clapped softly in acquiescence.
"Do you agree to the purification, Namchild?"
"I agree, old grandfather."
Santan clapped in imitation, and Owa bobbed his head, and from the pouch on his belt brought out a buckhorn. The tip had been pierced, and Owa had stuffed the horn with the chopped roots and herbs that he had gathered the previous afternoon. Now he picked a live coal out of the fire with his fingers, and juggling it to prevent it burning his skin, he dropped it into the trumpet-shaped opening of the buckhorn. He blew upon it, and a tendril of blue smoke rose in the still air as the herbs smouldered. Once the pipe was burning evenly, Owa rose and stood behind the two squatting women. He placed his mouth over the pierced tip of the horn and sucked on it strongly, then blew the smoke over them. It was acrid and sharply unpleasant, and left a bitter taste in Santen's throat. She murmured a protest and began to rise, but Hani pulled her down again. Owa kept puffing and exhaling, and after a while Santen found the smoke less offensive. She relaxed and leaned against Hani. The old woman placed an arm around her shoulders. Slowly Santen became aware of a marvellous sense of well-being. Her body felt as light as that of a bird, and she felt she could float up with the spirals of blue smoke. "Oh, Hani, I feel so good," she whispered. The air around her seemed sparkling clear, her vision sharp and magnified, so she could see every crack and crevice in the surrounding cliffs, and the groves of trees seemed to be made of green crystals. They reflected the sunlight with an ethereal radiance. She became aware that Owa was kneeling in front of her, and she smiled at him dreamily. He was offering something, holding it out towards her with both hands. "It is for the child," he told her, and his voice seemed to come from far away and echo strangely in her ears. "It is the birthing mat. His father should have made it for him, but that could not be. Here, Nam child, take it and bear a brave son upon it." Owa leaned forward and placed the gift upon her lap. It took long seconds before she realized that it was the chempsbok skin over which Owa had worked so long and so intently. She unfolded it with exaggerated care. The skin had been scraped and tanned to the pliability and softness of fine cloth. She stroked it, and the fur felt like satin. "Thank you, old grandfather." Her voice came from far away and reverberated strangely in her own ears. "It is for the child," he repeated, and sucked on the buckhorn pipe. "For the child, yes," Santen nodded, and her head seemed to float free of her body. Owa gently exhaled a stream of blue smoke into her face, and she made no effort to avoid it. Rather, she leaned forward to stare into his eyes. Owa's pupils had shrunk to glittering black pinpricks. The irises were the colour of dark amber, with a fan-like pattern of black lines surrounding the pupils. They mesmerised her. "For the child's sake, let the peace of this place enter your soul," Owa spoke through the smoke, and Santen felt it happen. "Peace," she murmured, and at the centre of her being was a wondrous stillness, a monumental calm. Time and space and white sunlight mingled and became one. She sat at the centre of the universe and smiled serenely. She heard Owa singing far away, and she swayed gently to the rhythm and felt each beat of her heart and the slow pump of her blood through her veins. She felt the child lying deep within her, curled in an attitude of prayer. Then, unbelievably, she felt the tiny heart beating like that of a trapped bird, and the wonder of it engulfed her whole being. "We have come to be cleansed," Owa sang. "We have come to wash away all offense, and we have come to make atonement." Santen felt Hani's hand creep into hers like a fragile boned animal, and she turned her head slowly and smiled into the beloved old face. "It is time, Nam child." Santen drew the chempsbok skin over her shoulders. It required no effort to rise. She floated above the earth, with Hani's little hand clutched in hers. They came to the opening in the hillside,
and though it was dark and steep, Santan went forward smiling, and she did not feel the coarse volcanic rock beneath her feet. The passageway descended for a short distance, and then levelled out and opened into a natural cavern. They followed Owa down. Light filtered from the stairway behind them, and from a number of small openings in the domed roof. The air was warm and moist and steamy. The clouds of steam rose gently from the surface of a circular pool that filled the cavern from side to side. The surface of the pool seethed and bubbled softly, and the steam smelled strongly of sulphur. The waters were cloudy green. Owa let his loincloth fall to the rocky floor and stepped into the pool. It reached to his knees, but as he waded forward, it deepened until only his head was above the surface. Hani followed him naked into the pool, and Santan laid the chemsbok skin aside and let her skirt fall. The water was hot, almost scalding, a thermal spring welling up out of the matrix, but Santan felt no discomfort. She moved deeper and then sank down slowly on her knees until the water came to her chin. The floor of the pool was coarse pebble and gravel. The fierce heat of the waters soaked into her body. It swirled and eddied about her, kneading her flesh as it bubbled up out of the depths of the earth. She heard Owa singing softly, but the steam clouds closed in around her and blinded her. "We wish to make atonement," Owa sang. "We wish to be forgiven our offences to the spirits." Santan saw a shape forming in the steam clouds, a dark, insubstantial phantom. "Who are you?" she murmured, and the shape firmed, and she recognized the eyes. The other features were obscure, as those of the old seaman she had sacrificed to the shark. "Please," she whispered, "forgive me. It was for my baby. Please forgive my offense." It seemed that for a moment there was understanding in those sad old eyes, and then the image faded and vanished in the steam banks to be replaced by others, a host of memories and dream creatures as she spoke to them. "Oh, Papa, if I had only been strong enough, if only I could have filled Mama's place." She heard the voices of the San in the steam, crying out in greeting to their own ghosts and memories. Owa hunted again with his sons, and Ahani saw her babies and her grandchildren and crooned her love and mourning. "Oh, Michelle," his eyes were a marvellous blue, "I will love you forever. Yes, oh yes, I will name your son for you. I promise you that, my love, he will carry your name." How long she remained in the pool she did not know. But gradually the fantasies and the phantoms faded, and then she felt Hani's hands leading her to the rocky lip. The scalding water seemed to have drained all the strength from her. Her body glowed a bright brick colour, and the ingrained dirt of the desert was scoured from the pores of her skin. Her knees were weak and rubbery. Hani draped the chemsbok skin over her wet body and helped her up the rocky passage to the surface. Night had fallen already, and the moon shone bright enough to cast shadows at their feet. Hani led her to the rude shelter and wrapped her in the chemsbok skin. "The spirits have forgiven," she whispered. "They are pleased that we have made the journey. They sent my babies to greet me and tell me so. You can sleep well, Namchild. There is no more offense. We are welcome in this place."